Sissy Roberts believes she has a family curse, being a listener, just like her mother. People tell her the bad things she doesn't want to know, things they wouldn't confess to a priest. Sissy is a young Lakota woman with dreams of going to college, but since she can't figure out how to pay for it, she works as a waitress and plays guitar and sings on Saturday nights with the Redbird All-Indian Traveling Band. The group's handle is also the name of Frances Washburn's third novel, set in the year 1969. As the book opens, the band is playing in a rough bar in scenic South Dakota, just north of Pine Ridge, for the 4th of July rodeo and dance. After the raucous night of drinking and dancing is over, Buffalo Ames is found dead along the railroad tracks near the bar. Because Sissy is the person who hears everyone's confessions, she's drawn into the FBI investigation into Buffalo Ames' death. The Redbird All-Indian Traveling Band is more than a murder mystery, though. It's the story of a young, strong woman at the beginning of a journey to fulfill her potential. Frances Washburn is an associate professor and director of graduate studies in the American Indian Studies Department at the University of Arizona. She earned her PhD at the University of New Mexico. She was born and raised on the Pine Ridge Reservation, and she joins us on the line. And Frances Washburn, thanks for joining us on the Dakota Midday Book Club.
Thank you for inviting me. It's a pleasure to be here.
And if you've had the opportunity to read the Redbird All-Indian Traveling Band, and if you have any questions for Frances, you can email them to midday@sdpb.org. You can also give us a call at 800-524-3604. And Frances, in writing the Redbird All-Indian Traveling Band, did you start with the character of Sissy Roberts, or was it the idea of the band, or something else completely different?
It's completely biographical, autobiographical. When I was just out of high school, I did some of this, not nearly to the extent that the character in the book does, but one day I was talking with one of my graduate students, and I just started talking about some of the crazy things that I did when I played with this band, and he said, well, you should make a novel out of that, and I said, well, okay, I never thought of that, and so that was the inspiration for writing the book. It's mostly autobiographical.
So you played in a band very much like Sissy Roberts,
yes.
A country band, sang Hank Williams tunes and that sort of thing?
Yes, absolutely. Yeah, Tammy Wynette, all of those people.
So what was it like then to go back to those early days and think about this and put it together in this novel?
Well, it was kind of a trip back into the past, nostalgia, and it caused me to remember crazy things that happened and people that I met along the way. Some of them were saints and some of them were sinners, and it was all a very fascinating time in history at Pine Ridge, and it was also a kind of turning point in my own life.
Well, let's go to that year, 1969. This is when the book takes place pretty much over the course of 4 months, beginning on the 4th of July. What was happening on Pine Ridge and Rosebud and in Indian country during this time?
I think there was an underlying upsurge of, think about it. It was right after the 1964 Civil Rights Act had passed, and American Indians were beginning to think, wait a minute, you know, we have been the most oppressed group in this country for 500 years, and so why is nobody paying any attention to us? And that was the beginning of the American Indian Movement, AIM, that started out in Minneapolis. And there wasn't outright rebellion or acts of civil disobedience on reservations, but I think the impetus for that was beginning. There was, it was kind of like the women's movement, I think. I think there was a lot of consciousness raising going on.
At the time, were you aware of this? I mean, did you feel like something was happening?
Yeah, I did, and I tried to point that out in one of the chapters in the book towards the end when the band was playing at Batesland, South Dakota, and there was the riot afterwards where people were running and screaming and yelling Red Power, because Vine Deloria's book, one of his early books had just come out, that was getting a lot of attention, both negative and positive.
This book, as we mentioned, takes place in the year 1969. Do you think that this story could be set in 2015 and still work? Do you think it would still be very much a similar story?
I think the same story could be told, because the underlying theme of the book is how difficult it is for a Native person growing up on a reservation to leave and get an education, how difficult it is to find permanent employment, to find whatever it is that they're seeking in life. And so, yes, I think those issues are still there. I think there would be certainly some changes, and some of them have to do with changes in federal Indian law and policy, the jurisdictional issues about who investigates crimes on reservations, who prosecutes it, what is the process for that. All of those things are changing. Not a great deal, but they are changing, and I think Louise Erdrich's book, The Roundhouse, addresses some of those issues as well. So in a way, I think of her book and my book as being kind of, they could easily be paired, with mine being the early situation with jurisdictional issues and her book being the modern update to those issues.
I introduced the character of Cissy Roberts a little bit in the introduction. What more can you tell us about her? And as you mentioned, a lot of this book is autobiographical.
Yeah.
How much of her is similar to you, and how much is different from the way you were when you were her age?
I'm very much like the character in that I always wanted to get an education and didn't see how I could do it. We are different in that I only barely dabbled in playing music with the band, and she is very actively involved. And, of course, I portray her as having far more talent than I ever possessed. I think those are some of the main differences. But that bit in the opening where I say that she's a listener, and it's both a curse and a blessing, and it's a family trait, that is very true. It runs in my family. My mother was a listener, my grandmother was a listener, and although I've never met her, I suspect my great-grandmother was a listener as well.
That concept of being a listener, how important is that for you as a writer and a storyteller? You mentioned that Cissy Roberts considered that as a curse and a blessing when it comes to being a writer and a storyteller. Is it very much a blessing?
Yeah, it is, because that's where you get some of the ideas for stories. You look around you, you listen to what people are saying and what's going on in the world and in the local community and right down to the family level. And those, you take those stories that you heard and you say, what if? Well, what if this was changed? What if that was changed? How would that make this story different or more interesting or better or teach something of value to somebody, give somebody some hope, some encouragement, whatever might be needed. Sometimes you think you're just telling a story. You're just telling a yarn. It's just for entertainment. But it never turns out to be just entertainment. If you look beneath the surface, there's always some message there.
Well, in looking at this book, The Red Bird, All Indian Traveling Band, this is a very entertaining book. It's a very funny book in places as well. But what is going on underneath, do you think? What is the deeper story here that you would like readers to come away with?
Okay, I have written three novels, and in every single novel, I have tried to address some challenge for American Indian people. The first book, Elsie's Business, the underlying theme was violence against women and how the perpetrator is rarely caught or prosecuted for that. The second one was about the Bureau of Indian Affairs and how they usurped or misappropriated, however you want to say it, billions of dollars in lease money for American Indian lands. And this book is about two issues. It's about the difficulty of getting education for not just for Native people, but for all people who don't have resources or family background to help them get that. But the second issue in The Red Bird, All Indian Traveling Band is about law, legal decisions, who has jurisdiction for prosecuting crimes on reservations. And a reader could read it simply for the story and say, you know, that was a pretty good yarn. I like the humor. I like the characters. Or they could say, wait a minute. Well, what about the difficulty of getting higher education? What about jurisdictional issues? And hopefully there will be one or two people who will look into it more deeply and maybe be able to contribute something of value to helping solve those challenges.
You're listening to Dakota Midday from South Dakota Public Broadcasting. We're talking with Frances Washburn about her novel, The Red Bird, All Indian traveling band. And do you think that's what makes a good novel, a good story, when there are these different levels that that readers can delve into, whether it's just the entertaining aspect of it or the deeper ideas that you're getting into?
Well, you know, I just think that every book, even something that is formulaic, like a romance novel, even a romance novel where it's the same story over and over and over again, boy meets girl, boy loses girl, boy regains girl. That's the whole theme of every romance novel that's ever been written. But there are still lessons to be learned even from that. And I don't think that I should be such a snob as to say that people who read romance novels are not looking for deeper issues, because there are deeper issues, even in a romance novel. And maybe one of those deeper issues is the need for all human beings to find somebody who loves them, that they can love in return. And maybe it's something just so simple as learning how to construct a sentence. Those are all important, too.
Well, love plays an important part in the Redbird All-Indian Traveling Band. Sissy Roberts, for example, is looking for love. She, her good friend, same age, her name is Speedy. She's also looking for love. So there's plenty of that in this book, too.
Yeah, yeah. They both. Well, that's just a very human impulse, I think. Of course it is. Everybody wants to be loved. And for these two women, Sissy is very afraid of falling in love with somebody and being trapped, and being unable to go on to get higher education, even though she can't figure out how to do it at the moment. She knows that if she gets married and has children, that's going to at least significant delay, if not completely kill, any hope of higher education. Speedy is just confused. Mm-hmm. Poor thing.
Now, do you see them as, do you write Speedy and Sissy as sort of, two different women, same age, they both live at home with their parents, they're both waitresses, but yet they have, would you say, different ambitions? It seems that Speedy is more interested in settling down and having a family, while Sissy wants to have an education, wants to get off the reservation or out of the way, away from this part of South Dakota.
Yeah, yeah. Speedy just doesn't have higher ambitions, and there's nothing wrong with wanting to have a children, a family, a husband. That's a very worthy goal in life, too. But Sissy wants something more than that. She wants it all, and I think she represents modern American Indian women and really women everywhere, no matter what their race or class or ethnicity.
The female aspect, the female perspective in this story, is that... obviously, this is written from a female perspective. Is this a voice that is important, that perhaps sometimes isn't told, particularly with stories from Lakota or Native American stories, contemporary stories?
Yeah, I think so. Some of the most famous Native American novels, the ones that have become iconic, of course, the one that comes to mind for most people is Housemaid of Dawn, which Scott Momaday's novel that won the Pulitzer Prize, I believe, in 1969. Most of the characters are mixed-blood male characters. Frequently, they are returning war veterans. And I think those characters are important, but I think that story's been told. I think it's time that we tell the story of the women, and I think it's time that we tell stories of women who may not be mixed blood, or if they are mixed blood, why would that mixed blood have to be white and American Indian? What about African American and Indian? And that's what I did with the main character in my first novel, Elsie's Business. She's a mixed blood character. She's a woman, but she's African American and American Indian.
You're listening to the Dakota Midday Book Club from South Dakota Public Broadcasting. I'm Carl Gerke. We're talking with Frances Washburn about her novel, The Redbird All-Indian Traveling Band. You mentioned that Sissy Roberts is very much an autobiographical character. You were born and raised on Pine Ridge. Did you have ambitions of being a writer?
I think that I was born a writer. I just had to learn the alphabet. Mm-hmm. And I do believe that that's true of all writers. You either are a writer or you aren't a writer. I don't think it's anything that you can learn. I think that you can learn how to be a better writer, and that you learn by reading and by writing over and over, and the more you write, the better you get. But I always wanted to be a writer. I can't remember when I didn't want to be a writer.
What did you write when you were young?
Oh, I made up short stories. Of course, I was always the heroine of all of those stories. And I was embarrassed by them, though. Somehow I thought that being a writer was something that was totally unattainable. And for a long time, for me, it was unattainable. I'd write them on pulp paper tablets with a pencil, and then I'd hide them. And then I'd bring them out and write on them some more. And then my mother found them, and I was so embarrassed I wanted to die, because, of course, it was quite obvious that the main character in these little short stories was me. So, I've always written, but I never had the opportunity. I got married far too young because, you know, that's what a lot of young women do if you don't have an opportunity to get an education. You get married, you have children, and then I was raising children and then got divorced, and then I was on my own for 20 years before I was able to even begin trying to publish anything I wrote. But in all that time, I wrote wherever I had the opportunity. I wrote during my lunch break at factories. I wrote on the backs of envelopes at 2 a.m. while I was feeding my children. I was constantly writing something or other, sometimes just a scribbled line or two of a poem or something. But I've always done it. I can't stop it. It's a curse and a blessing.
Curse and a blessing again. Now, you mentioned that you were sort of embarrassed and ashamed when your mother found your writing. What was her response when she saw that you were writing?
Well, she kind of had this little twinkle in her eye, and I knew that she knew the main character, who was this wonderful person, was me, but she didn't make fun of me for it. She neither encouraged nor discouraged, but she told me, you don't have to hide them anymore.
And how did that make you feel? How did you respond to that?
I felt that it was okay. It was okay to want to be a writer. Even if I never achieved the goal, it was okay to try for it.
When you were doing all of that writing, have the ambitions of getting the things that you're writing published, or was this just something? It almost sounds like something that you just had to do. That you really didn't really have any choice. You were a writer and you had to write, and that's what you did.
Yeah. Well, both. I was a writer. That's what I had to do, and I had no choice. I've kept a journal all of my life. And so I have all of these notebooks, which I hope somebody burns as soon as they find out that I'm dead. But, I also wanted to publish some of it. And I've never cared whether or not people loved it or hated it, as long as there's one person reading it. But I didn't want to be the person who's playing music to an empty room. What's the point then?
Now, you teach now at the University of Arizona,
right.
At what point did you start working on getting advanced degrees, going to college, getting your advanced degrees, getting your PhD, and getting into teaching at the University of Arizona?
Well, I was 44 years old before I ever got to start college, even as an undergraduate. And all of those years before, I was, as I said, I was raising my children, and I had several jobs, and at one time I had three different jobs all at the same time, and I like to tell people that I did anything that wasn't illegal, immoral, or fattening to support my family. But then I had an injury to my back, and I was unable to work, and so I was living in Albuquerque at the time, and I applied for disability, and I immediately knew I didn't want to live on disability for the rest of my life. I wanted to do something useful. So I went to the disability services office there, and I said, well, what can you train me to do to make a living with my particular injury? And they gave me this whole list of things, and then they said, or we could send you to college if you can pass the exams. And I just sat there. The woman must have thought I was a nut because the tears were rolling down my face because she just handed me the opportunity to get an education that I'd wanted all my life and never could get. And so I took the exam, I passed it, and Disability Services helped me to get into college and to pay my tuition to start with. And so that's how I got into college. And I knew that at 44 years of age, I'd better move fast before I was too old to even get a job, let alone I wanted to do something useful with the education that I had. So it took me 9 years to go from nothing but a high school diploma to a PhD, and then I was hired here at the University of Arizona, and I've been here for going on 12 years, and I just feel like, you know, I'm one of the luckiest people in the world because I get to love to do what I love for a living, and that's I get to teach and I get to write. What could be luckier?
Your first novel, Elsie's Business, what did that feel like then when that was published, when you got to see that for the first time? There's your book and your name on it.
It is indescribable. It's like winning the lottery and having your first child and getting told that you're not dying of cancer all rolled up into one. I actually wrote that one while I was working on my dissertation because I had a visiting job at University of Nebraska at Lincoln, and I was teaching a 3-2 class schedule and trying to write my dissertation at the same time, and I was just going crazy. And so I started working on Elsie's Business just as sort of therapy to get me through it. And then when I was done, I submitted it to the University of Nebraska Press because it was right there. And didn't hear anything for months and months and months. And finally they said, well, we don't think this is quite right for us. And I said, okay, well, I guess that's that then. But then about a month later they said, oops, we're sorry. We didn't realize that it had already been sent out to reviewers, and they say they like it, so we're offering you a contract. Huh. It was wonderful, just wonderful.
So what do they mean, already sent out to reviewers?
Oh, well, if you send a book manuscript to a university press, mm-hmm. It isn't an in-house decision on whether or not to publish it. They send it out to at least 3 outside people who read the book and then decide if it's worthy of publication. So I had to pass 3 outside reviewers rather than an in-house committee.
Oh, so that must have been quite rewarding then, knowing that this book was accepted and people enjoyed it or thought it was worthwhile.
Absolutely, absolutely. I can't think of the word that I want to use. It's gratifying.
Gratifying. Yeah. You're listening to the Dakota Midday Book Club from South Dakota Public Broadcasting. I'm Carl Gerke. We're talking with Frances Washburn. Her third novel is The Red Bird All-Indian Traveling Band. It's the story of Sissy Roberts, who plays with a country band. She has dreams of going to college. And in this book, as I mentioned, there's some funny moments, some wonderful characters in this book. I'm wondering for people who read this, do you see this as helping them get a good flavor of what life is like, particularly in this area around Pine Ridge and Rosebud?
Yeah, the main thing that I wanted to do with all of the various characters, even the background characters in this, was to get across the point that American Indians are just human beings. American Indians have the same emotions, the same hopes, the same aspirations as everybody else. We're all human beings, and that's the main point. There are 2 characters, however, in this book who are actual real people, and I use their real names with their permission, of course. One is Joe Hiller, the kid who's the bull rider in the initial chapter of the book, or rather bronc rider. Joe Hiller is a Lakota person. And when I came to work at University of Arizona, it turned out that he was here. We had never met. He was a professor over in the ag department. And after about a couple of years, we were talking about growing up in and on and around Pine Ridge, and he told the story about the monkey and the bar. And then it hit me. Oh, my gosh, I was there. I was playing in the band that night that the monkey in the bar thing happened. And so I just stuck that in the book for fun, and partly because I wanted to tease Joe Hiller a little bit. And he read it and liked it and gave permission for me to use that and to use his real name. The other real character is Tom Holm, the FBI agent. The real Tom Holm is a professor emeritus at University of Arizona in American Indian Studies. And Tom and I are really good friends. He's also a novelist, writes terrific stuff. The Osage Rose is one of his books. Anyway, Tom absolutely hates the FBI for a variety of reasons, but he is a Cherokee person, And so I knew he hated the FBI, so I named the FBI agent after him, just for fun, just to tease him. And so he read the manuscript before it was ever published, and he said, "Wait a minute, you named that character after me?" And I said, "Well, I'll change it if you want me to." And he said, "No, don't change a thing. That's exactly what Sissy would do, so just leave it." So those two characters are real people. The other characters that are in there, there is no one character in there that's based on somebody else. Sonny, the cousin who's in the band, Clayton, who's the leader of the band, and Melvin, and all the other characters, there's no one person they're modeled after. They're all kind of composites of several people I have known and some imaginary characteristics thrown in as well.
You mentioned the monkey, Julius. That's the name of the monkey in the Longhorn Bar. There's also the golf tournament, the little boy that picks up the golf balls on the greens during that tournament. Also, the various bar scenes. It sounds like you like to have fun with your writing as well.
Absolutely. If you can't have fun with it, then what's the point of doing it? You know, I think maybe I am happiest when I'm shut up in my room, in my comfy old ragged chair that the cats have clawed up, with my laptop on my lap, writing. I think Thomas, or rather Stephen King, said it best. He said that when he's writing, the whole world disappears and he falls through the pages and into the story. That's the way I feel as well. I can be there for 4 or 5 or 6 hours writing, and look up and all of a sudden realize that all that time has passed and I have been in an entirely different world.
What has been the response to not only this book, the Red Bird All-Indian Traveling Band, but your other two books, the other two novels? What has been the response to those books, particularly from Native readers and perhaps people that live on Pine Ridge and Rosebud?
I don't get much feedback from Native readers. And I think part of that is because most Native people are so absorbed in just trying to make a living because, you know, the poverty rates are just incredibly horrible. Unemployment on Pine Ridge is approaching something like 60-70%. And when you think of the national unemployment rate, it being hovering around 5.5%, something like that, you can imagine how horrific 60-70% unemployment is. I think most Native people who are reservation-bound don't have time to read those books. They're much more busy with their own lives. But Native people who are not on reservations, and really, the urban Indian population is much, much bigger than the population that still lives on reservations. Those people are the ones that seem to have been the most interested in my books, and I get emails and feedback from people that say they like it, and I'm happy that they do. That's the point, that I don't want to be the person playing music to an empty room. But as far as other people that are interested in the books, well, they've been adopted as textbooks at universities all across the country in classes, American Indian literature, American literature classes, gender and women's studies, political science, history, all kinds of classes and all kinds of universities are using my books as textbooks, which I find very gratifying. But really, I just want to make one person who reads the book think about something other than their own problems for a little while. That's good enough.
I'm curious as far as the storytelling tradition, the Lakota storytelling tradition in particular, if that has any role in your writing, if you see some of that in your books.
Oh yeah, absolutely. Oral tradition is still alive and well in almost all American Indian societies, and really, I think non-Native people don't think of themselves as having oral traditions, but of course they do. Every society does, and maybe they just don't think of it that way. I think people think of oral tradition as, the trickster stories about Coyote or Iktomi the spider and all of those stories. Well, yes, those are oral tradition, but so is the story about the crazy uncle who came to Thanksgiving dinner and fell face down in the pumpkin pie, and all of those families, that's oral tradition too. I'm just telling my own stories. Some are family stories, and some are Lakota stories. And the first book, Elsie's Business, is actually a modern retelling of an old Lakota oral tradition story, the Deer Woman story. So, yeah, all of my books have some basis in oral tradition storytelling.
Do you have a current book that you're working on? I know that a lot of writers don't like to talk about what they're working on right now, but I'm
I don't mind at all talking about it. I actually have 1, 2, 3 novels done, none of which are about Native stuff. I mean, there's touches of Native stuff in there because that's what my background is, but it's not the main point of the story. One is Outliers, which is finished and is going to an agency in New York for hopefully to be published with a commercial press this time, because they get wider publicity for those novels. Outliers is about the current economic inequality and what would happen if governments collapsed and corporations ruled the world, and you were not a citizen of a country, but a citizen of a corporation. And then there is a second book, Last Colony for Alibaba, which is a science fiction novel. And then there is a third one that's a time travel novel, kind of a mashup of time travel to the Middle Ages. And then the fourth one that I'm working on right now is another American Indian novel, and it is about endangered species. And raises the question, are American Indian cultures endangered species? And that came from the idea that my father worked on La Creek National Wildlife Refuge for the last 25 or 30 years of his life, and he was involved with the project to save the whooping cranes. And so as a child, I grew up with that sort of sensibility around me of how important it was that we save these species, that they're valuable, not just for the way they look or the way they feel, but because we're all connected and everything and everyone is important.
Well, those sound like some wonderful books to look forward to. Frances Washburn's third novel, most recently published novel, is The Red Bird, All Indian Traveling Band. It's published by the University of Arizona Press. And Frances, I want to thank you so much for taking the time to talk with us on the Dakota Midday Book Club. It's been a great pleasure.
Thank you. I've enjoyed it so much.